Okay, well, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
There's two that are still awake. Hello. You sure it wasn't real wine? We just had a shot. People listen to the recording of this, we find that very odd. We just took communion, if you're wondering, at home. So what you can do now is you can pause the tape, go and get your own communion, and then you've joined in. And I say that not just to be silly, but actually because it does matter, because part of the passage we're looking at tonight for our New Testament a year includes what we now know as the Last Supper. Now, if you don't know what the New Testament a year is, where have you been? Welcome. We're halfway through February, which means you've got plenty of time to catch up. We are aiming as a church to read the entire New Testament in 1 year. Yes, the entire New Testament, and yes, in an entire year. It's not as much as it sounds. It really, really isn't. In fact, daily, it's actually most time, I'd say an average of 20 verses or so. It really isn't. If you're a quick reader, it means you can bang it out in 20 seconds. If you're a slow reader, a minute. It really isn't a huge thing. It's the daily discipline. It does mean that if you are behind and you're panicking, you're thinking, well, we're up to Matthew 26. That's today's reading. 26 to 50, flipping heck, I've missed nearly 26 chapters. It's okay. If you start tomorrow, it's cut off the bottom because it's ironic. But if you start tomorrow, you read 4 chapters a day, you'll be caught up by next week. Okay, so a week, 7 days' time, 4 chapters a day. Now, that honestly is not a lot. It'll probably take you about 15 minutes a day of reading, and you could be caught up. And then you're into the 30 seconds, 1 minute by readings every day. Really, really do encourage you to do this. And if anyone does drop behind, because it happens, life happens, it's fine. Just double up, triple up, whatever you need to. Really encourage you to do this. It's really, really good. It's a good discipline. But also, you'll come across scriptures that you maybe forgot existed, or maybe, dare I say, you've never actually read. We've read all the bits around them, but those one random verses, those random bits. For example, how many donkeys did Jesus ride into Jerusalem on? Yeah, you're going to get to that, but yeah, everyone thinks one, but actually it says two. It's things like that you think, hang on a minute, I didn't know that. So it's definitely worth doing. So catch up with it, get on with it. If you've not started, then just start. Just start tomorrow. 4 chapters a day, and then you'll be caught up. It's on our social media. You can go to BibleGateway.com. That's the reading we're following. There's lots of New Testaments a year. We're following their one, so it's online. You can just check it out. There you go. So I am looking at most of the passage today. The first bit we've already heard from Louise. That was the reading of the Lord's Supper as told in Matthew. We've taken communion. I'm going to pick up from just after that. And I've given this a title. I don't normally title my talks, normally because I feel too restrained. I'm not a sort of, you know, 5 points all beginning with P type person. But today, I felt really kind of led that God was saying, this is a reminder that God succeeds where humans fail. And I mean, that happens a lot throughout scripture. And I think this is, Matthew is, as the writer, is really trying to hammer this home, that we are not good enough, but God is. Now, that's way too small, but if you've got a Bible, then you can follow along. It's just so you get your Bible out. Matthew 26, we're going to read from verse 30. If you can see that, then great. You don't need to go to your next eye appointment. Just tell them you read the Bible in church. It says, when they sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus told them, this very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Peter replied, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. Truly I tell you, Jesus answered, this very night before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. But Peter declared, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the other disciples said the same. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee along with him. And he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. Going a little farther, he fell on his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will. Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." Then he came back. He again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come, and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." So that is almost all of today's reading. So the bit before that was about what they did at the Lord's Supper. And then there's a little bit after this, which shows Judas coming up with the mob of people to arrest Jesus. He gives Jesus a kiss, and then Jesus is arrested. But I wanted to kind of focus in on this section. And what this reminded me of is something that actually happened nearly 19 years ago. Now, this has got nothing to do with a mob of people coming to arrest anyone in a garden, but it was the whole idea of things not going to plan, as you'd expect. The disciples thought, this is great, we've got this Messiah, he's just done this amazing thing with us, he's just told us a new meaning for the Passover, and there's a new covenant, and isn't this amazing? And then the things that unfold that night, in their minds, all seem to be going horribly, horribly wrong. And about 19 years ago, you may or may not know this, I was relatively newly employed to the church. And I started in the week, and the first weekend was a weekend away, already planned, organized by the volunteer leaders. And so I, as the new employed youth worker, was to go away with them. I was 19. I turned 20 on that weekend. So on the Sunday of that weekend, I turned 20. So I was young. I knew nothing. I thought I knew everything, but I knew nothing. And that weekend was great, all organized, wonderful, sounds good. It was snowing. If everyone says it doesn't snow in the world, it does. It snows every few years, we just forget. And it was snowing as we left. And as we went further north, because for some reason this weekend wasn't somewhere nearby, not North Wales, not Cheshire. No, I think it was at the back end of Yorkshire somewhere. We were driving for hours through the snow. Two minibuses in front of me being driven by volunteers, me in my car, young people I'd only met a few days previously in the car for the first time. And as we were going along this A road, it was saying, highest A road in England. So many people died this year on this road, next sign. So many people had crashes. I'm thinking, oh, this is a good route. Snow's getting heavier and heavier. The minibus in front of me starts to slide about. It's okay. The ex-minister's wife was at the wheel. I thought, Kathy's got it. It'll all be fine. And what I'm doing is I'm sitting in this car thinking, we're all going to die. It's my first weekend away. I've been in the job 4 days, and it's all going to go wrong. But it was fine. We got there. We got to our place, and of course, it was down a slope, which was fine for my car sliding down. Try and get two minibuses down a slidey slope. Let's just say we didn't have young people up a tree with their feet against the side of the minibus to stop it from sliding off. Because if we did have that, that would be really dangerous, and someone might want to know about it. But anyway, we got there, and it was all fine. First night went great. We had some worship, and it was a great night. Everyone settled in. They were a fantastic bunch of young people being led by some really great, enthusiastic volunteers. Hello, am I still here? I thought that was my fault. We had someone there doing the food. Everything seemed to be going great. They play pranks on each other, you know, little thing. Oh, we've done this. Oh, we put your trainers in the freezer. Oh, isn't that funny? That was fine. But there were two lads there who were probably, my first impression of them were these are incredibly well-behaved, well-educated, well-spoken young men. These boys, they seem to know everything about everything. They do all the tech in the church, and great to have them here. In fact, they were so techy, they decided that they would bring a little tool with them on the weekend. They brought this. They had borrowed a smoke machine from their school. I did not know they had this until 5 a.m., Sunday morning, I've just turned 20. Happy birthday to me. I hear a bit of noise outside my room, and I think, oh, they're going to play a prank. And I hear giggling, and I hear the undescribable ripping sound of duct tape, if you know what that sounds like. I can hear, and I'm thinking, they're doing something. It's either my room or it's the girls' room. It's 5 a.m. What could go wrong? Well, about half an hour later, there's all sorts of noise, banging, fire, fire, the boys are shouting, smoke starting to kind of creep under my door. I burst into my room to find them in the hallway with a smoke machine, hose connect to it, pointed into the girls' dorms rooms, which they've opened slightly, duct tape up the crack, and they've tied the two room handles together so the girls can't get out of their room. The girls, obviously, are starting to panic, and they're thinking, oh, what a hilarious prank, until, obviously, what goes off? The fire alarm. 6 a.m., fire alarm goes off, we have to, and then they're desperately panicking, trying to untie, rip the duct tape off, get the girls out of their room, we all have to evacuate, and I'm thinking, okay, this is great, we'll deal with this. And then the unmistaken sound and noise and lights reappear, and a fire engine pulls up. Of course they do. This building's basically made of wood, and it would have burnt down very quickly if it actually been a fire. And I am stood less than a week into my job, just turned 20, explaining to some Yorkshire firemen why it was a prank that had all gone horribly wrong, and I'm really sorry, and I know you don't think it's funny. I don't think it's funny, and they are very sorry, and please don't charge us for the call-out. It was, in my mind, an utter disaster. Oh, my word. Once the dust has settled, they all saw the funny side of it. Those lads, by the way, are amazing, and it's felt so, I was told, that's very out of character. I was like, well, it's not out of character, because they were the geekiest lads I've ever met, so that level of prank was very them, but they would have been absolutely mortified about how much trouble they caused. And it was just a classic example to me of like, okay, and honestly, I went home from that weekend thinking, well, this is going to come from my door at any point. This will be it. You know, you were in charge, and this is what happened. But actually, the weekend was incredible. The weekend for the young people was an amazing time. God really turned up, really did amazing stuff. They had incredible time. We had 3-4 foot of snow. It was ridiculous. They tried to do an egg drop challenge out the top window, which everyone passed because the snow was so thick, you could have thrown the egg with no covering. It would have been absolutely fine. It was an amazing time. And just that one moment had me thinking like, oh my word, it's all gone wrong. It's all, but actually, God was still doing amazing things amidst the chaos. And this is reminding me of this today's passage, because I just thought that weekend, oh my word, but actually, what an incredible time, and what a baptism of fire a little bit, but it was amazing. The disciples have no idea what's about to happen. They've just had an incredible meal. They've just had a great time. They've just had that amazing time of worship together. And Jesus says, this very night, you will all fall away on account of me. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Jesus comes out and goes, by the way, guys, tonight, you're all going to leave me. It's all going to go wrong in your mind and you're all going to leg it. Now, of course, Peter is not happy with this. If you know anything about Peter in the Bible, Peter is the kind of say it first and then think about it later. He's a strong, kind of confident man who will do anything to protect his rabbi, to protect his savior. So he says, even if everyone deserts you, I will never. It's like he said to them, they may be rubbish, but I'm not. I'm kind of like the pseudo leader here. Like they can run off. You'll have me no matter what. And Jesus says, do you know what, Peter? They may like leg it, but you are going to go one step further. You're going to actually deny even knowing me tonight. 3 times before the rooster crows, you will deny me. And Peter goes, no way. No, I would die with you. I will die before I see any harm come to you. But yet we know that's not true. We know that that's really, for Peter, couldn't have imagined how wrong that night for him would have gone. We don't know exactly what it would have looked like, but there is a bit of a dramatization and maybe possibly a little bit like this, that he's gone from being Superman in his own head, I will die for this rabbi, I'll do everything I can, to maybe someone acting a bit like this. We don't know exactly how it went. Obviously, there weren't cameras there, but it really was. When you read the account in John, it's not just that, oh, I don't know him, but John paints this picture of how Peter is stood outside a court while Jesus is being falsely accused, looking for anyone to stand for him. In Jewish law, he's meant to have a witness stand with him, but he didn't, which is what made the trial illegal and for one of the many reasons. And Peter, his best friend, the guy who said, I'll die for you, he's out in the courtyard, warming by the fire with the mob of people, and he's fervently denying even knowing Jesus. So that first thing for Peter was like, wow, really? I'm going to do that, not a chance. And Jesus is like, actually, you are. You're not just going to fail. You're going to fail big tonight. And Jesus goes on because he takes them to a place called Gethsemane. It's a garden. And he tells them, sit here while I go and pray. And he takes Peter and the two sons of John, which is John and Andrew, with him, the two guys who he's closest to. The three. They're like his inner circle. They were like his three best buddies that he kind of hung out with. All disciples matter to him, all his followers, but he had these three that he often brought in for special occasions. And he says, I want you to come with me deeper into the garden, and I'm going to pray. And he says to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. So stay here and watch with me. Jesus wants to go and pray. He knows what's coming. He's told his disciples that he's going to be taken, that he's going to be killed, but don't worry, I will rise again. But he knows that that doesn't all happen in a blink of an eye, that he's going to go through a process which is going to be painful, which is going to be scary, and ultimately is going to mean separation for the first time in all of eternity for the Son from the Father. So he's a little bit stressed. And so he wants his friends to come and watch with him. And he goes and prays. And the Bible says that he falls on his face. It's not just he gets down and says a little prayer. He doesn't take a seat on a rock. The Bible says that falling flat on his face, he prays. Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. This is a deeply heartfelt prayer. And I think this is where we start to see the real combination of humanity and divinity in Jesus, the perfection of man and God coming together. Because we know that Jesus was fully God, but also fully human. We're told this. We're told that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We know that everything about Jesus was everything that we are as a human, but also everything that God is as our God in this mysterious, miraculous combination. And so I'd like to kind of suggest that when we have this Son of God, who is the fullness of God, he's the same deity, he has all the knowledge and all the power, he could do anything, he could click his fingers and the whole world could be reset. But he's also fully human. He has a body, he has a mind, he has a soul. He has the same issues that we have. He has to go to the toilet, feels the hot, feels the cold, feels emotions, sadness, anger, fear. And I'd like to suggest that in this moment, that he was fearful. We know this because in Luke, it says that he was so stressed out that he was sweating drops of blood, which is something that is a very rare medical thing that apparently can happen when you are so anxious, so that you can cause capillaries to break and it bleeds into your sweat glands. And blood, it's not like, you know, big, thick blood, but it's like bloody water. It's kind of like red sweat. How stressed out, how panicky he is. The humanity of Jesus, I think, was on his face before God saying, do I have to do this? Do I have to go through this? Because I am so scared. I am so worried about what is to come. And I don't think it was just the physical pain and torture, although that has got to be part of it. But like I said, also the understanding that for the first time in all of eternity, the Son was going to take on the sins of everyone and everything and be separated from the Father. A place that no one would ever want to be, let alone Jesus, who had spent all of existence being connected to the Father and to the Spirit. And so he's stressing. I think he's struggling. And the reason I say that is because it's not just because he's face down on the floor praying, but he does that and he has his time with God and he gets up. And he gets up and he goes to his disciples and they're not there and they're not responding. And so he does it again and again. And it's a real struggle. And I think the thing that reminded me about this is I love this analogy of gardens. Gardens are great in the Bible. If you ever look at a garden in the Bible, there's usually something going on. I don't know why, they just love a garden. And the last time that you think of this struggle between humanity and divinity, such a crucial point, you have to go way back to Eden, where you find the temptation of man there to do what God wants, God's will, or to do what man's will was. And we think of where Adam and Eve were tempted. And we know then that humans gave in to temptation. Humans went the route that they wanted instead of the way that God wanted. And I think this same struggle now exists in Jesus. The humanity of Jesus didn't want to go through what was coming next, but the divinity of Jesus knew that what was to come next had always been destined to come next. And in this struggle, we start to see that God takes over, that God's will is done. Jesus would have known from the Psalms, "My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." Jesus would have prayed knowing that although he as a human might have been struggling, that he as God could achieve anything. "God is my strength and my power," it says in 2 Samuel. And I believe in this moment, we see this perfection where God was able to say, "It's okay. This is my will. You know this is my will. And so this will be done. And it will be done by me in you. You are a perfect combination of man and God for a reason. No human could do what you are about to go and do. No human will be good enough to go and do what you are going to do." And so Jesus' prayer about this cup being taken from him, I think that's where we see the humanity. "God, if there's any other way, if you can take this off me and we can find another way to do this, then I am up for it." But he always ends his prayers with, "But not my will, but yours be done." So when he finds the disciples sleeping, it's a fantastic analogy. Where, what has happened to the humans in that moment? Well, they're asleep. They've given up. They're not battling anymore. I mean, you could say, why blame them? It's late, it is. They've had a meal, and we all know. Give a man a meal and a few hours, he's having a nap. That's what happens. But they were knackered. It was tired. Their flesh was struggling. So Jesus says, "Keep watch and pray so that you will not give into temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak." And I think as much as he was talking to his disciples, I think he was also pointing out the battle that he was going through himself. That his human body right now was struggling, that the flesh didn't want to go through what was coming, but the Spirit of God was saying, "But this is what will happen." But the disciples slept. Despite him going off and praying a second time, he came back and they were still there. And as this cartoon says, Jesus told his disciples to watch and pray. And the time-honored tradition of sleeping in church was born. Maybe, maybe not. But the point is in this moment of pinnacleness of the gospel, because I think we know the cross is amazing. We know what happened on the cross is incredible. But I'd like to argue that the journey of the cross began with this moment. Because Jesus could have said, "Do you know what? Actually, I've got another idea. Why don't we go and do this? Why don't we just, I don't even need to die, do I? I could just, look, let's just have me rise to heaven right now. Let's just bring another biblical, whatever it is." But in that moment in the garden, where humanity was failing, but God's divinity was winning, the cross, the work of the cross, the miracle began. So Jesus went away a second time and he prays, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." The eagle eyes amongst you may have already noticed Jesus' prayer the second time, although it looks very similar, it has now shifted. The first time he says, "If it is possible, let this cup pass from me." The second time he says, "If it is not possible for this cup to be taken away, then may your will be done." The first time he's saying, "Is there another way? Can we find another way?" You can see the humanity of Jesus is struggling, is wrestling, is fearful. The second time, it's like the divinity starts to take over and goes, "If this is the only way, then your will be done. I'm not necessarily looking for a way out anymore. I'm realizing, I'm accepting, I'm knowing, I'm trusting, I'm believing. This is your way, God, and this is what will be done." It's like the strength within him was growing, and not from a human place, but from a godly place. And I think, how often does this happen in our lives? How often do we hit a point? Where it's the strength of God is the only thing that keeps us going. We may not have had that moment in that garden where we want to walk away and give up. We may not have had that moment where we're fearful to the point of death. But we've had plenty of times, I'd like to argue, we think, "God, I do not know how I can carry on." And God says, "It's okay, because I will. I will carry on. This is where I get to step in and bring the miracle and make it happen. So, of course, he finds his disciples. They're still sleeping. Because by this point, they've settled in, really, haven't they? If they didn't wake up a second time, they're not going to wake up the third time. And Jesus, he doesn't scold them anymore. He just says, you need to get up. Because actually, I've prayed second, I've prayed a third time, and something is going to happen. The thing as well, there's so many messages in this, and if I feel a bit all over the place, I apologize, I'm trying to hone in on the one message, but this passage is incredible. There are, I reckon, four sermons in this one passage, just saying. And I've touched on one. I'm in the middle of the second one. I just want to briefly mention the other one. Jesus prayed, and he prayed, and he prayed. The same prayer-ish. It kind of shifted towards understand what God's will, but he didn't just pray once and go, that's it, I've run now. He repeatedly prayed, went back, and he prayed, and he prayed, and prayed. And if ever an example of why we should continue to petition and pray, well, if Jesus did it, then we should do it. So he prayed, God, does this have to happen? He prays, God, if this is your will. And we're not told what he prayed the third time in Matthew. But he comes back far more resolved, far more confident than when he started. You can imagine that prayer time was him saying, okay, let's do this. And so he returns, he wakes the disciples up, and he says, are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. It moves from the start of this passage to, can you come and watch with me? Because I feel so sorrowful to the point of death that I need to go and pray. And I'm asking God if there's another way. And by the end of it, he comes and says, come on, guys, get up. It's time to go. Because here comes the guy who's going to betray me. The confidence shift is amazing. And I think it's where we see that the humanity got before God and was real and was honest. And God said, this is okay, because I am in this. I have always been in this, and I will carry you through. It's not that it was a different Jesus, but I think when we bring that together, that combination of humanity and God together, sometimes at some point God got to take over, and Jesus was reminding himself even, you've got this. You've always had this. Let's get on with it. And the thing about the cross is that he was arrested, he was taken away, he was put on trial, he was tortured, he was beaten, he was taken through the streets, he was taken outside, he was hung on a cross with other prisoners, and this was seen as something, as a victory to all the people who wanted him dead. To the disciples, it was seen as, it's all gone wrong. It's like the smoke machine and the fire brigade turning up. This was not meant to happen. None of this was meant to happen. How on earth did it end up this way? And in that moment, it was seen as, is this God winning? Is this not? Is this part of the plan? Is this not? But we get to look back and see that actually it was. It was not a foolish thing. What man thought was a win for them, what those priests and those religious leaders and those Roman soldiers thought was a win for them, was always actually God winning. We fail all the time because we're human. We make all sorts of mistakes. We will get it wrong. We will mess up. We will forget things, do things wrong, say the wrong thing, not do the right thing, whatever it is, because we are not perfect. No one else could go through what Jesus did. None of the disciples, not even Peter. Well, he went and denied him. Only God himself could go through. God's wisdom was not to come in like he could have with a mighty army, storm through, destroy the Romans, destroy everyone. Don't listen to me. Okay, you're dead. Join me or die. He had every right to do that. God has every right. But instead, he sent a man to be a servant, a man to suffer, a man to go to the cross, where everyone thought that was a loss and that was the end of 3 years of teaching, 3 years of a new message. To God, it was just the beginning of his victory. God's wisdom is far beyond what we can ever imagine. And I think when we beat ourselves up, or when we struggle, when we think, actually, I'm not good enough for this, or I can't manage this, you've got to remember that as a Christian, you might not be, but God in you is. God is going to bring the victory. God is going to work through you in areas and places where you never thought you could imagine. I couldn't have imagined 19 years ago, after that weekend away, that I'd be stood here right now preaching. Honestly. Make of that what you will. But if I've done anything right, I've done anything good, it's because of God. The Bible tells us, for the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Even in his weakest moment, flat out on his face, possibly begging for another way to bring about redemption for the whole world, in that moment of weakness, Jesus was still stronger than anyone else could ever have been. It's only ever been about Jesus. It had to be Jesus. God and man together. Because if it had been more man than God, it may not have ever happened. So Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 12:10, "For Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." What I think is beautiful about that moment to Jesus is that when the humanity of Jesus was struggling, the strength of God shone through. And I think that is the same for us today. Church, when we struggle, when we are weak, we can trust that God will be strong. And it's not because he doesn't want to be strong all the time, but I think sometimes we get in the way. We want to do it ourselves. I've got this, God, it's fine. And sometimes maybe that's okay. But there are other times when we've just got to recognize, I can't do this, so I need you. So I will pray, and I will pray again, and I will pray again, and I will pray, and I will seek you, and I will trust you, and I will give it over to you, and trust that you have got it. I'm going to end now with a song by Lauren Daigle. It's called You Say. It's going to be a lyric video on the screen, and it's going to give us a bit of time just to think. I just feel the words were just a real good sum up of what I felt God was saying to us through this passage, and then the band are going to come up during the song and take over. But if you want to pray with anyone during this, if you feel actually there's something that I know I'm struggling with, that I need the strength of God in that moment, or I need to be reminded that God's got me, then I encourage you to find someone in this room that you trust. It could be a friend, it could be someone sat with you, whoever, and they will pray with you. There are people in this room who can make sure that no one does anything weird to you, so you'll be looked after. No one's going to take your wallet or lick your face or anything like that. They're going to give you space to just pray. And let the words of the song and the melody kind of wash over you and let God do his thing.